It is 3:07, and this meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Members present are Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Ivy Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already done so, so we don't have any surprises, or else you're going to buy us all donuts. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber, as always, the House Health Secretary from Records, and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, the only item that we have on the agenda for the next 45 minutes is a presentation from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. Today, it looks like everybody's all up and queued, so I'm going to let you guys formally introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Reinhart. I'm the Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and I'm from Anchorage.
Does it get closer?
Hi, I'm Maggie Winston from Kenai. I'm the chair of the Governor's Council.
Jean Gerhardt Cyrus, Kiana, and I am a council member. I also chair the work group on FASD, and I am co-chair for the Developmental Disabilities Committee, and I serve on the CESA board.
And today we're going to give you a presentation, kind of an update on several things going on with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, including an update on our FASD five-year plan, autism, and some of the other things that we've been working on, including some of the things that have been follow-up to bills that have been passed by the legislature. So I will start and hand it over to my colleagues at certain points. So the Governor's Council has multiple roles in state government. We're not only the Developmental Disabilities Council that's kind of required by the Federal Developmental Disabilities Act. For that role, we get a chunk of funding that comes from the federal government to be the Developmental Disabilities Council. We're also the State Interagency Coordinating Council for infants and toddlers with disabilities. For short, we call that the ICC, but basically that's a requirement of the Federal Individual Disabilities Education Act, and so that's one of our roles. We're also a beneficiary advisory board to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We're one of four of the beneficiary groups represented by the trust, and we're the governing body of the Special Education Service Agency, or CESA as we call it. And we're also the Special Education Advisory Panel for the state, under the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. So we do that on behalf of the Department of Education and Early Development. So even though our council is located component-wise in the Department of Health and Social Services, Senior and Disability Services budget, our roles and responsibilities cover multiple systems and departments in the state. So we kind of work on a five-year planning process, and we just finished a five-year plan where we took input from all around the state and in all different ways. And these days, the days of going out to multiple communities everywhere and doing public forums, even though we did a few of those, it's more or less done by surveys and people being able to call into things and talk to us, participating in public forums that we already have. Like when we had a meeting this week, we had several people to come and testify. We collect all that data, and then we develop a five-year plan. And our five-year plan this year is we've kind of come up with five different goal areas. It's empowered to live and thrive in the communities, competitively employed in integrated settings. We feel very strongly about employment being one of the areas that we work on, and it has been for a number of years, but it remains so. Under education, skills for education, success, and independence, receiving appropriate services and supports, and improved quality of life. So all of our objectives and activities for the council kind of fall into these five different areas. We have a couple bills that we're going to talk about that we that are not yet quite developed, but they're very close to being developed. And we want to let you know about them. If you haven't already been meeting with some of our council members, you may have already heard about them, but we're going to, for the purposes of this presentation, give you a brief overview of two of them. And the first one is the shared vision bill. And Maggie, you're going to do that, right?
Sure. Yes.
May we check in?
Hi, and thanks again for having us. Again, my name is Maggie Winston. I'm from Kenai. And so for around the past year, we have been working on this shared vision for DD services in the state of Alaska, DD standing for developmental disabilities. And so there has been these project teams of individuals coming together with state agencies, service providers, families, individuals, care coordinators, in order to provide better services for individuals that experience developmental disabilities in the state of Alaska. I have been part of one of the project teams as well. Essentially, and if you, the vision up here in our own words is in this, the bolded part in blue, wanting to make services more person-centered. And person-centered is in this vision so that people are in control of the services that they receive in an integrated community setting. So the big part is that individuals can receive these services in their home and community of their choosing. Push the next slide, please. So the idea being that when people are receiving person-centered care, that it just makes them have more meaning to their life. Personally, I receive services in Kenai. I own my own home. And I'm a mom. I have twin boys that are 13. And the only reason I'm able to be able to live in my own home and be a mom and work at my job, I work at a center for independent living in Soldotna. So the only reason that enables me to be able to do these things with the most independence and autonomy as possible is through the services that I receive. And so in light of, you know, the budget climate and the fiscal climate in the state, essentially, there's going to be a difference of opinion and how these services are provided. And in reality, you know, there's going to be disagreements and there's going to be tough things that happen to people. And I am currently experiencing that as well. I've been receiving 24-hour care in my own home for about 13 years, and recently was cut to 35 hours per week. It's just it's a reality that we all have to face, you know, and that if that were to come to happen, then I would be living in a nursing facility and not be able to live in my home anymore and not be able to be a mom to my kids and to be able to go to work and to do all the things that provide meaning for me in my life. What we are really aiming to do is set a sustainable future in statute that will enable people to look forward to the future and be safe in knowing that the services will be provided to them.
Ms. Winston, I have a question.
Sure.
So you've moved from 24/7 back to 35 hours a week?
It's currently in the process of appeals, so not yet.
Okay. Are you going to be able to do 35 hours a week?
No, I would need to live in a nursing facility.
And that would be more expensive than in-home support? Yeah. All right.
So we have this graphic up here that we like to share, and we updated it from last year. But back in 1997, we had Harborview Developmental Disability Center in Valdez, and we closed it down to this effort, moving everything towards home and community-based services. And we did a little projection out there in terms of how much how much home and community-based services cost versus the institutional care And the calculations we came up with is basically about a third of the cost. So if we didn't have the home and community-based waivers existing for our clientele, then it would certainly be a much more expensive prospect for the state. And there are a few people that do live in out-of-state institutions that have not been able to serve, or if they burned out through providers and families and stuff mm-hmm. up here, it's very minimal. And there's a few people that are in Alaska Psychiatric Institute that have developmental disabilities and other co-occurring disorders that resulted in extreme behavior issues. So, and they may have burned out their system. There's some there as well, but for the most part, all the clientele in our state that are eligible for these waivers, we've since back in the mid-90s have said this is the way to go. And we keep looking at this kind of projection going towards, as Maggie said, a meaningful life. And that means, you know, employment, living in the community, being able to do the same things everybody does.
While we have a pause, I'm going to recognize that Representative Sadler's been here since about 3:10, and we have a question from Representative Johnston.
I guess I'm chewing this over. With healthcare, with any population, you have 7 to 8% of the population as the big cost driver. You know, that who is in that 7 or 8% can change throughout years, but it's basically, anyway, 6 to 8% really. Do you have something similar? Do you feel, I mean, it almost sounds like to me that there's a percentage of high cost drivers, and then there's a percentage where this home base really is much less expensive and you get to the third. Do you have a sort of a general percentage over a 10-year period?
Well, Representative Johnson, through the chair, I don't have available the 10-year projection, but it's something we could probably get some information on if we go back several years. I do know that the department has done a very good job of doing the comparison of each of the waiver costs and versus, you know, there's four different types of waivers. There's institutional care, there's personal attendant care services, and I know that Director Mays is behind us in the audience there. We just recently got a copy of the most recent ones from last year, mm-hmm. looked at a comparison from the year before, and you see some of them up a little, some of them down a little. Mm-hmm. But for the developmental disabilities waiver, the average cost is about $89,000 per person. The average. So, yes, there are people on the upper end of that spectrum that cost more, and there are some certainly that are less. But for the individuals with developmental disabilities waiver, it's approximately $90,000.
It would be interesting to get that. So, Ada, if you could give it to me,
Representative Johnson, I believe that Director Mays presented that, showed us that infographic last year, and perhaps I'm looking at him now and asking him to make sure to include it in his budget presentation when he presents to the Finance Subcommittee. Thanks. Representative Q.
Thank you, and through the chair. So what decision or what situation prompted the change from 24-hour care to 35-hour care?
So without getting too complicated, a change in services. So there are a few different type of services that individuals like myself can receive. Previously, it has been group home services. Mm-hmm. And there are some regulations with group home services that come with all kinds of different convoluted regulations also. So for a little more freedom and independence, I decided to move to a different type of PCA services and supported living services. I also receive like supported employment and day habilitation and some other services like that. So a switch in services prompted that.
And through the chair, follow up. Is this a situation that is happening to other people with developmental disabilities? Is this something that's happening across the board?
Many.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Just to follow up a bit from my colleague here. So was this a Medicaid change or was it state change?
State.
Okay.
All right. I think you've answered the questions thus far, but you've clearly piqued our interest.
So, okay, oops, that's too far. So do you want to finish this or do you want me to? So we have this shared vision bill. The idea is, you know, put this kind of lens in statute. It's not necessarily about, you know, today. It's really about the future, but today as well. It's what we want all future administrations to look at when they're looking at the home and community-based services is through a particular lens. So working with Senator Matricki's office, we're working on some draft language that could be added to the statute. It's basically kind of a preamble to the services that are available through this home and community-based services, and it's more of an aspirational language type bill rather than any kind of a direct request for services. It's a lens that we just want to put over the top of all these services, and it leading to, as Maggie said, meaningful lives for citizens with disabilities. And Jean was going to talk about our next one.
Jean Gerhardt Cyrus. Supported decision making refers to a third opportunity for people who might need, who might in the past have automatically been given, granted a full or a limited guardian. And supported decision making really goes well along with the DD vision, which is for more, for people to have more control over their lives and be able to choose where and how they want to live. And so it is really a civil rights issue. And while some people may need full guardianship, not everyone does. And therefore, it's not the least restrictive environment. And everybody uses supports to make decisions, I believe. And just because people need more help, they may not be able to do, say, financial decisions, or maybe they need help with medical decisions or those kinds of things, should not preclude their rights to maintain decision-making power over their own lives. Representative Charisse Millett is going to have this bill. I think it's supposed to roll out tomorrow, is my understanding.
It's very close. We understand.
Currently, with people who need public guardians use the Office of Public Advocacy, the recommended ratio for a guardian to a ward, which is what someone's called who has that service, is 1 to 20. The average in other states is 1 to 40, and in Alaska it's about 1 to, I think at last count, 109. And so the opportunity to do any kind of discussion or planning with the individual is pretty limited, if non-existent. And so there's not the input. Supported decision making will provide equal access for the individuals, and it would add a third opportunity so that an individual can establish a team and bring in the people that they want to have a discussion with and be able to give input into their life decisions. And it might not be for everything. It might be just that they just can't do finances. Then that would be all it would address, and it would be a contract and, again, allow people to have more control over their lives to be able to live it the way they want to instead of it being dictated by somebody. If you live in the rural areas and have an OPA guardian, you never lay eyes on them, and they never lay eyes on you because it's just the reality. It has been enacted in other states positively, and there seems to be pretty positive support for this. We haven't heard any negatives.
And we just recently heard that the governor's budget has an increase in the Office of Public Advocacy in relation to this, so we certainly would support that. So we're pleased to see that. Jean also has the next couple of slides.
Okay. So Jean Gerhardt Cyrus again. And I serve as the chair for the work group on FASD, which is housed in the Developmental Disabilities Committee of the Governor's Council for Disabilities and Special Education. We have a new co-chair now, which is Hope Finkelstein-Stein, And she is the Office of Opioid and Substance Misuse. And so she is also tasked with supervising the FASD diagnostic teams. And FASD is fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And at our last meeting, we may have met and or will be meeting quarterly. Our last meeting was on the 22nd. And you have the work plan available to you. I believe it was emailed, and there were also hard copies. So it is literally hot off the press. But we finalized the vision, and we approved the work plan. And so you have the vision here. And our goal is that Alaska become an FASD-informed state. We have six goals. Raise awareness. FASD is a range of disabilities. It does not affect everyone together. It depends on the time of exposure, the amount of exposure, and also genetic differences. Even twins can be impacted differently. Another goal is to reduce the incidence of alcohol-exposed pregnancies. This is 100% preventable, providing we have the supports and services that women need and families need to support healthy pregnancies, because it's not just a woman's issue. Three, this is really important, and I'm really glad this is one of our goals, is to address the stigma. There used to be a lot of stigma attached to autism. And, you know, we heard about refrigerator moms. And now that we've gotten over that, we've been able to make a lot of progress on the autism front. However, the stigma remains in terms of FASD, and particularly aimed at birth moms, but also aimed at individuals who are impacted, who appear to be typically developing. But we don't see people's brains necessarily, and so we don't see how those processes are or are not working. So this is huge. This is another goal. And then four, reduce the co-occurrence of childhood trauma and FASDs. We very often know who the high-risk families are. We need to get supports to them. And even for families that are not high-risk, who are raising children, often multiple children with an FASD, they need to have access to those supports. A lot of people don't realize that many people who have an FASD do not qualify for services in the developmental disabilities program. They may have similar needs, but they don't meet the qualification. And if they do meet the qualification, they cannot get a waiver unless they have a diagnosis, one of the five diagnoses that is outlined in the federal regs. So this is sort of a real void. It's a huge void. What happens then if those children are failing at home because their parenting is different, and or in school because they're not responding to typical strategies, there's chronic failure. And it's not just the individual, but it impacts the family. And if the family doesn't have support, or the family is struggling with addiction or other issues, and the child ends up in foster care, then there's another issue with foster parents not having the training, and that child being moved and moved and moved, and often ending up in residential. Too often, I should say, ending up in residential. So reducing the co-occurrence, addressing FASD-informed care, and advocating for fully funded appropriate services. We are not asking for things at this point. We have formed five work groups and we'll have the support of our staff, well, Hope, and also Lanny Momsen from the Gov's Council. We have funding from the trust. We have partners from, I counted up 18 different entities, from Women and Child Health to foster care, facing foster care, diagnostic teams, infant learning or independent living centers, Volunteers of America, DJJ, Senior and Disability Services, huge range of individuals that serve on these work groups or the committees, priority area groups. We struggled with how do we break it down. Mm-hmm.
And we will be meeting quarterly, and we will, each work group will be addressing the top three objectives, which we were selected during our last meeting, and developing action plans. And part of those action plans, a very important part, is identifying resources. Who are the people, agencies, entities that we need to bring in to address, whether it's early childhood or it's systems transformation, or if it's prevention, whatever it is, who are the resources that need, who are the players that need to be at the table? And looking at finances, is there somewhere where we can identify those finances, or is this something we need to start looking elsewhere for financial resources to address this? Let's see, behavioral health, a lot of times, there are co-occurring disorders, but a lot of times when someone experiences chronic failure, they develop behavioral health issues, and then it becomes a behavioral health issue. But I believe a lot of that can be prevented if we have those services and supports. And I think that's all I have. And again, you do have the work plan here.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. These are, through the chair, these are great goals. What I'm struggling with, and I'm not sure, it's been a while since I've been involved in this discussion, but as far as addressing the stigma, one of the stigmas is diagnosis. And I know that even Kiana, you know, that being diagnosed has been an issue. Are you addressing that so that we can follow through with the rest of the goals?
Through the chair. Just clarification, are you talking about availability of diagnosis?
Availability, and then, I mean, as I say, I haven't been involved in this for probably 10 years now, but there was an issue of not just availability, but families even allowing diagnosis.
Through the chair. I think it continues to be an issue. There's some exciting things that are happening. The All Alaska Pediatric Program
Partnership.
is going to be doing neurodevelopmental screening for all neurodevelopmental issues as early as possible. In that regard, we're looking at more what's the issue than what's the cause. And so that, I think, is going to help with diagnosis. And I think it's part of addressing that stigma issue. You know, we've got to try to address that and look at what is the reason people are drinking during pregnancy, you know, and it's not because they want to hurt their babies. And so we need to get past that and get on to looking at addiction and really looking at what's the point. We need to help people.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just remembering that a couple of years ago, the state had funded a project to put pregnancy tests in bathrooms. And so I was just looking to see, I guess it was May of 2017 when the results came back. And I think that project, you know, is no longer happening. And so I was looking in your priority area number one of primary prevention of FASDs. You know, you mentioned the LARCs in here, the long-acting reversible contraceptives is, you know, one of the things in the priority areas. You know, just that whole conversation around, you know, how to educate women and how early in a pregnancy. You know, when that project was going on, was there any discussion in the community about whether, you know, it seemed to be working? I mean, the results were that, you know, of course, this, I believe, was the way the surveys were done, were voluntary, you know, at the bar without, I don't think, any follow-up. So what it says is, you know, 42 women said that they found out they were pregnant, you know, from having that availability of the pregnancy test and committed to stop drinking. But unfortunately, I don't think there was any follow-up to know if that actually came true. So I guess if you could just comment about, you know, whether you thought that project was a good idea or have any thoughts on that, and then, you know, how that kind of fits into your prevention strategies.
Through the chair, I am not on that prevention work group,
okay.
But I think anything that is effective in preventing alcohol-exposed pregnancies. And Senator Giesel shared with us that there were actually five women, I think, that wrote in after they had taken the test, found out they were pregnant, thanking, giving thanks for helping their babies be born healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, again, anything that provides that message and that helps prevent alcohol-exposed pregnancies mm-hmm. is worth it. I don't know specifically if that work action group will be taking that up, but I'm sure, I know it came out in our discussion mm-hmm. during the whole work group meeting, too. Mm-hmm. So.
Follow up, please. Thank you. And so it looks like, you know, from yours, you know, Medicaid reimbursement for LARC, so, you know, getting even a little bit further upstream, it looks like, has been maybe prioritized as a little bit higher priority. So, you know, preventing unwanted pregnancy is sort of where you're putting some effort as opposed to, you know, I guess this other, you know, research that was done was more, you know, by providing the pregnancy test. So, you know, one of the things that I guess I just wondered about that is, you know, depending on when the woman took that test, there could have already been a lot of alcohol exposure. And so, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how much of an impact that could have. But you know, if there are some women who found out, and like you say, these five, you know, a lot of the work we do, we just hope if we can help one person, we made a difference. So, that may be a lower cost kind of alternative. And so if you think we should be doing things like that, please share that with us.
Through the chair, and we don't have a lot of asks right now, but those are the kinds of things I think are going to be coming out of the priority area groups. Okay. And we have, we're really pleased to have women, children, and family, very, very involved partner with this group because for that reason they know about what's out there. And you're right. That is much more upstream than, oh, I am pregnant, mm-hmm. you know. But, again, anytime we can stop it, there's no further damage at least. But,
I just want to take a moment and to personally recognize you, Ms. Gerhardt-Cyrus, for your work on this subcommittee. It's been a lot of work. The appointments have shown up on my calendar all year. I have not participated nearly as much as I would have liked to, but the quality of the plan that has come out, the comprehensiveness of it, gives me some hope. I think for a lot of people, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are a very invisible disability that a lot of people, a lot of Alaskans for a very long time have suffered through. Addressing fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in the depth and the comprehensiveness that's defined in this plan gives me hope for the future. We often know that people didn't even recognize what fetal alcohol spectrum disorders looked like and didn't understand that there was a range, let alone that there was ways to help people who are on the spectrum, adapt and be more successful in life. Professionals often didn't know how to test very effectively for fetal alcohol spectrum. I have a daughter who's on the spectrum who essentially failed a fetal alcohol spectrum test because because of her own cognitive challenges forced her to sort of emotionally shut down during the process. And that for me just says that we have a failure of the way that the system is designed if we can't even get somebody who's clearly on the spectrum to be diagnosed as such, because we're not, you know, approaching somebody on the spectrum where they are. And I think that it's very exciting, and I just want to call you out and the entire committee that worked very, very hard over the last year on this. It's really impressive work.
Thank you very much, Representative. And I want to say, you know, there are people, myself, that have been involved in this for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of expertise that we have access to here, it's really exciting. This I feel like we are getting, you know, now we can get some traction because we've done a lot of talking, and now we have we'll have action plans.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right, and I just want to give you a heads up. We're getting a little bit tight on time. I think we can plan on about 10 minutes from here now. Okay.
Thank you. So quickly, just an update. We do have an autism ad hoc group. We're kind of following up on the work that Representative Sadler and former Senator Johnny Ellis did, and the council has followed up on many of those things. Some of the big issues that we've been dealing with is the fact that we were losing the state's neurodevelopmental specialist, pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist, who retired, and we're happy to report that we have one and another one coming into the state, so we're very excited about Dr. Siv Fossey starting at Providence, and then Dr. Randy Zernbach starting at South Central Foundation in the spring. There's been 11 rural outreach clinics on this, and the Center for Human Development at the University of Alaska has started a very unique, we call it Alaska Echo Autism. It's basically where we can include the expertise of people in this field from around the country into a video conference type format to deal directly with when doctors and other practitioners are dealing with folks with different issues. They can bring those through this kind of this multidisciplinary video conference format to talk through some of the issues and problems that they might encounter in their diagnoses as well as provision of services. So that's a cool trial thing that's going on that we hope to see expand.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Well, actually, Madam Chair, it's not a question as much as a comment. The good work of the FASDS task force was preceded by some very good work. We had an autism task force that was created by the SB 74 in this room, and I'm looking forward to seeing their presentation to see how the findings and recommendations have been implemented. So thank you.
I'll also take this moment to recognize that Representative Edgeman has joined us. He joined us about 4:40.
So another issue.
3:40, sorry.
Okay.
I'm off an hour.
Okay. One of the other big issues, and I think it was one of the primary recommendations from the work done by the task force was that the state adopt regulations that allow for the use of applied behavioral analysis. It's a type of evidence-based treatment that we previously weren't covering under Medicaid, and so the state has been going through a fairly lengthy process of developing those opportunities, and they're still going through the process, not quite done yet. The council had an opportunity to review the draft regulations and put it our comments, utilizing the our own autism task force, or not task force, ad hoc group, to look at those and see what some of the issues were. And we listed some of them on there, but I won't go into them right now. We're running out of time, but we do know we're getting close to this at, in terms of being able to use Medicaid to pay for this very valuable evidence-based service. Another issue that's come up, and I think Gene alluded to it just earlier, that this concept of doing a developmental disability screening statewide in across this, you know, different segments of the state is a big issue. You've probably seen some of the folks from the All Alaska Pediatric Partnership in the building this week, and they're promoting this. We're partners with them along with everybody else. We've been pulling together a developmental screening work group, and they've been part of it as well as us. We really feel the sooner we can get a diagnosis for families, for any their young children that experience a developmental disability, the sooner we can get them into services that really can change the whole outlook of not only that individual but their family. So we're very excited about the work being done on this universal developmental screening. It's being done with lots of different partners that we greatly appreciate. And then Maggie was going to do a quick update on our ABLE program, which was the Achieving Better Life Experience Act on the federal government. It's a savings program. So, Maggie?
Okay, so the ABLE Act was passed in August 2016, and Alaska's been doing pretty good so far. December was when the first accounts were able to be opened, and we had a few, so now there are, you can see the numbers up here, 94, and plenty of money in funds. So this is helping individuals with disabilities be able to save for things related to their disabilities. I see people in my office or take calls on the weekly, usually for ABLE accounts. So there's more and more people getting interested and opening accounts. I am currently benefiting from an ABLE account. Mm-hmm. So we thank you all for your support. Outreach we're still doing. So we're really pushing through social media and through different avenues, just trying to get the word out there to be able to benefit more individuals.
And I couldn't leave this subject without thanking Representative Sadler for his hard work in getting the ABLE Act passed in this state. We worked with his office quite a bit during that process, so thank you again. A few years ago, we passed Employment First legislation. It was, again, kind of aspirational language, but it was basically why not ask the question every time we deliver services, publicly paid services, to the folks that we work with, people with disabilities, you know, what do you want to do for a living? And it's something that always wasn't there. So a few years ago, we put Employment First legislation in place. Once again, Representative Millett at the time was the person who got us going with that. And it's all about just looking at these services through the lens of what do you want to do when you grow up? And all of our children get asked that question. We expect the same for children with disabilities. And if we change that expectation and keep emphasizing that expectations with families across the board, from a very early age, we can expect a long-term shift in this attitude. We know, and with just young adults with disabilities in schools, they think they're going to work when they get out of school, just like everybody else does, and that's the expectation we want them to leave with. So this is a long-term kind of policy shift. We look at the different services and programs and just keep adding that question. Where is the work piece and what you want to do? We've had a few really positive things go on in the last couple of years. Repeal of subminimum wage. People may not know this, but you could pay some people with disabilities a lower wage with approval. It's a federal law. This state, through the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, has decided no more here, and we certainly supported that and commented that in that respect. And I believe on February 16th, that's the cutoff for no more subminimum wage paid to people with disabilities. So we've had a lot of other things going on. You can read them, but it's across many departments. We work with the Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Labor, with the support of the Mental Health Trust, and we'll keep you apprised of that as we develop. A lot of jobs have come out of it, and we're very pleased with it. That's it. So thank you.
All right. Is there any questions? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we're probably pressed for time, but I'm not remembering the particulars, but it's been in, like, the last 6 months, I want to say, that I was reading about a U.S. Supreme Court case related to services for kids in school, children in school with disabilities. Does that sound, do you know anything about what's going on with that? It was like, I think a parent actually was who brought the suit forward, and so then it was challenging the Department of Education and, you know, in terms of defining services, and it seemed like it was, you know, it was concerning when I read it.
I think I have heard something of that, and I have a person on my staff who's an expert in that area, and I'd love to have her come and talk to you about that, but she would know more about the specifics of that. But okay. Our education committee, I do remember that issue, and it does have some impact, but I would have to have her answer that for you.
Please.
But I will
that.
Have her contact you. Thank you.
Any other questions? I just wanted to comment on the Employment First update. I have to say that I'm pretty excited about that. We all gain a lot of meaning in our lives from our work, in our culture. We define ourselves
you know, in a lot of different ways by how we work. And it's important that everybody be able to work in a way that provides them meaning in their life. To say my daughter, who's on the spectrum, now works at a local coffee shop in my community, and her affect is has changed so much because she's really happy, because she's developing confidence. She has the respect of adults and peers that she works with. She's so happy working. She almost, like, it was an afterthought that money came with it. And now we're working on the skills around that. But, I think that work gives people meaning and focus, in their life. And it's exciting to see that we're making progress in those ways. So thank you very much for coming to testify today again, as you do every year. It is now, 3:52, and this meeting of the House Health and Social Service Committee will come to an end, and we're going to start the House Finance Subcommittee in about 5 minutes.